This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We're going to turn our attention to Detroit, pensions, racism, and bankruptcy. Detroit's economic woes can be tracked to capital flight, governmental policies, and the results of institutional racism, not the wages and benefits of its public workers. But ignoring these bedrock realities, Michigan's Governor Schneider has appointed an emergency financial manager for the financially strapped Detroit, Kevin Orr, who has rushed into bankruptcy, seeking to balance the books on the backs of the workers. Familiar. His bankruptcy filing will result in the pilfering of workers' pension funds.
While fundamentally ignoring the causes of the city's fiscal crisis, bankruptcy will seriously wound pensioners, despite the fact that the unfunded portion of the pension funds are minuscule and it is unconstitutional under Michigan's constitution. Orr's undue attention to public worker pensions is part of a nationwide trend targeting the retirement security of working Americans, especially pensions, Social Security, and Medicare. And with us to talk about this is Roth Eisenberg, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, and Richard Eskow, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future.
Well, one of the things that hit me about what's happening in Detroit, it kind of reminds me of what's happening in Cyprus. The depositors were bailed in, not out. They were stripped of a major portion of their deposits to recapitalize the banks. Well, in Detroit, isn't it the municipal workers who are being bailed in, stripped of a major portion of their pensions to save the banks?
This is Richard Eskow. I mean, I think there are some parallels. I think that, the Cyprus case was shocking because it showed the world what international financial policymakers were capable of, and it was unprecedented to think of going after depositors' money in order to pay for bad bets by the banks. I think Detroit follows a somewhat different pattern. Morally, there's some connection, but Detroit follows the pattern of whenever there's a fiscal problem at a government institution, the answer always seems to be go after middle-class pensions, go after middle-class wages, even though these things have suffered enormous contraction for reasons well out of the control of the people being involved. In fact, although those people have already paid a large price to begin with. So in the case of Detroit, for example, you have them saying, we can't afford these pensions anymore because of Detroit's financial crisis. Well, financial crisis was caused by global forces well beyond these working people's control. The bulk of Detroit's financial obligations are not pension related. And even if you break open those pension obligations, for example, and you ask yourself, how did a $1.4 billion pension fund suddenly incur $2.7 billion in obligations, and you find that derivatives transactions with the banks are responsible for the difference. We don't know enough about that additional obligation, but we do know it was bank-related. So I think that morally and just as a practical matter, this is not a fair thing to do for the people who gave their 30 years of work to the city of Detroit and deferred some of their compensation in pension form, and now to tell them they're not allowed to get it is extremely unjust, in my opinion.
Ross, we took the title of this piece from an article that you wrote, Detroit Pensions, Racism, and Bankruptcy, and a number of points on that in terms of white flight and also the treatment of the city by the state, and especially in terms of revenue sharing, and I guess a lot more. If you could expand on that theme and tell us what's been happening over the last 30, 40 years that brought us to this point.
Well, Detroit really is an extraordinary story, and Detroit started out as a very much majority white city. And over the course of the last 50 years, basically it lost 1.5 million white residents. They started leaving in the 50s as jobs moved out to the suburbs. Almost all of the new investment that the auto companies did in the Detroit area was done in the outlying suburbs and outlying communities. None of it was in Detroit. So obviously workers followed the jobs and the white families did, and they never stopped. And at various times, there were incidents like the Detroit riots in 1967 scared families, white and black, and the white families who had options left in droves. It accelerated the outflow. But finally, by the 2010 census, there were only 75,000 white families left from a base that was 1.5 million to begin with. So that story, I think, is the most important story, along with deindustrialization of the whole entire United States, and its effects on the auto industry have been very dramatic, hurting employment in Michigan and even in the surrounding Detroit communities. But that white flight, which was, I think, you know, you can't call it anything other than a racist response to a growing population of blacks in the city, as people came up from the South, as black families expanded, as they came from other northern states. The whites in Detroit refused to live in the same neighborhood as blacks, and they started leaving, and they never stopped. And I guess they probably still haven't stopped, even though it's down to 75,000 people.
And the defunding of Detroit in terms of revenue sharing from the Michigan budget, which started, I think you said, in the late 50s or 60s and continued up until the present day?
Well, when Detroit became a majority black city, which was, I think, around 1980, that was the first census where Detroit was a majority black city, its relationship to the rest of the state and to the state government changed pretty dramatically. And there was a hostility among rural legislators and legislators in other parts of the state to share revenue with Detroit. And so there was a lot of pride in Detroit. Coleman Young had an attitude that was very belligerent toward the white power structure, and they didn't get along at all. And so relationships worsened, and the state shared less and less revenue. Finally, we got to the point where John Engler, of all people, made a deal with Dennis Archer, who had been a Supreme Court justice in Michigan, a Michigan Supreme Court justice, and was then mayor. He promised to provide $333 million a year in revenue sharing to Detroit if it reduced its income tax, if it capped the income tax that the city could put on workers in the city. And so Archer made that deal, and then soon afterward, the state was hit by the 2001 recession and started reneging on its promise. And that continued all throughout the Granholm administration and continues today. And I think if you add up the amount of money that the state had promised to send and didn't send to the city in revenue sharing, it would exceed the pension liabilities that they're trying to eliminate, their obligation that the emergency manager is trying to discharge in bankruptcy. The state, in a moral sense, owes more money to Detroit than the sum total of those unfunded pension liabilities.
Ross, one of the things I was wondering, is there a proposed solution that could have avoided either robbing the pensioners or scaring off the bondholders, a state-owned bank, for example, where you don't have to worry about the interest rate swaps or be beholden to the bond vigilantes? What do you think?
Oh, I'm sure that there are lots of solutions. I guess I can't say I've studied enough to propose one that would work, but I would start with the state providing a lot more revenue to the city. The state is responsible for the city. It's a subdivision of the state. I mean, you can see what the relationship is. It's the state that imposed the emergency manager on the city. So nobody claims that Detroit is really an independent entity from the state. So I would look to the state for more revenue. I would look to the federal government to do something like a Homestead Act that would encourage people to move back into Detroit. I personally don't think that the city, with its infrastructure for 2 million people, is viable with a population of only less than 700,000 and people whose income is way below the median in the United States. It's a very poor city. Something like 35% of people in Detroit have an income below the poverty level. So Detroit probably is not sustainable without a lot of outside aid. But I think it's in the interest of everybody in the United States that Detroit survive. It's certainly in the interest of people in Michigan and the surrounding communities that Detroit survive and revive.
Ross, the attack on the pension funds in Detroit is said by the state constitution says you can't do this. It's protected
right.
by the state constitution, and there's
right.
a,
it's perfectly clear.
Right. And first of all, most of the pension fund is only a small percentage that's unfunded liabilities there.
Well, it's more like 80 some percent, but it's better than many. It's not a catastrophe.
So do you think the bankruptcy court can get around this? What's going on with that?
That's an excellent question. You know, I don't think it's been resolved whether the bankruptcy court feels that it can ignore the Michigan Constitution. What's clear is that the emergency manager is extremely hostile to the workers and their interest. He's extremely hostile to the notion that they have guaranteed pensions. You know, people who have worked 30, 35 years who were promised these pensions and gave up salary and other benefits to get them, the thought that he can, as cavalierly as he is, just throw them into the pot and say he's going to reduce them. The average pension is like $19,000. So people are not getting rich. They're barely able, a lot of people, to survive on the pension that they have. It's unconscionable that he would ignore the Michigan Constitution and do this. And I hope that there's a remedy even after bankruptcy, even if the bankruptcy judge were to go along with this, which I hope that he won't. I would hope that there is a remedy under the Michigan Constitution for what is a violation of the Constitution on the part of the governor and the emergency manager who are state officials, for them to ignore the Constitution and try to reduce these pensions is illegal, it's unconscionable, and there ought to be, and I hope there is, a remedy.
Richard, one of the things that, certainly I don't see that Detroit's bankruptcy poses a systematic or systemic risk in any way to Wall Street and global financial markets, but it certainly seems to pose a systemic risk to Main Street, really, to local governments and to the contractual rights of pensioners.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that the one issue that we need to be clear about is that whatever the city manager, the emergency manager, Kevin Orr's personal motivations may be, this is very much a part of a larger picture. These emergency manager laws themselves have been encouraged by groups like ALEC, Corporate, the American Legislative Exchange, the Corporate Funded Group for State Legislators. It's been something they've been pushing in other states, including California, where if a city runs into fiscal difficulty, the state can overrule the elected government of that city and appoint a city manager. And in many cases, it's been a Republican governor appointing city managers for emergency managers for Democratic cities. And there is a pattern throughout the country of blaming pensions, singling out from a city's entire range of financial obligations worker pensions as being outrageous and getting the public worked up as if these were enormous killings that these workers were making, when, as Ross points out, it's the average is $19,000, and by the way, some of them don't have Social Security. So I think that, there's a very large and systematic pattern here, and we've seen at the same time assaults on Social Security benefits, which should be increased, but we've seen calls to cut them in various wages, with the president going along and deficit commissions and so on. So I think this notion that a decent retirement is somehow American reality is really pretty central to a certain political agenda, and I tend to see what's going on in Detroit as reflecting that. First of all, to overrule the local government, then to declare, attempt to declare bankruptcy legally, and then to void the pensions and to single out the pensions without looking at some of the other causes and forces behind Detroit's difficulties. And, you know, because Detroit is an extreme case in terms of the nature of its financial difficulty, the 40,000 abandoned buildings, the rapid depopulation, because it is so shocking, it's almost the perfect shock doctrine case to pick to set a precedent for cutting pensions as they've wanted to do in Vallejo, California, or other cities around the country. So I think it's one we need to watch very carefully for precisely that reason.
Well, Detroit's bankruptcy certainly also threatens to change the rules of the municipal bond game, and already it's making it more expensive for the state's other struggling towns and school districts to borrow money and fund the big infrastructure projects. We'll continue to look at this critical thing because it has tremendous implications for other cities and our own as well. We've been speaking with Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, and Richard Eskow, Senior Fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and I hope you'll come back and join us as we continue this discussion over the weeks and months.
Thanks for having us.
Trust me on this one. We spent our prom night reading the Constitution.
Yeah!
So we've got a message for Governor Snyder. When it comes to honesty, integrity, and democracy, Governor Snyder, you're no tough nerd.
No.
You're nothing but one big bully.
Yeah!
This summer, hundreds of young union members from across the country have gathered together in Detroit, Michigan, ground zero for recent anti-union attacks.
This group of AASME members calls themselves the Next Wave, and is made up of new and young union members who have joined together to stand up for the rights of working people across the country.
There's no security for us. We'll go year by year sometimes not knowing if we're going to be in a budget or not. You know, we've lost so many friends to budget cuts, to layoffs, to privatization, to outsourcing. It's insane.
Unions, I think, are the only voice for the middle class, for working people. No one else is really advocating on their behalf.
And when it comes to implementing, for example, deferred action, when it comes to fighting for more union, pro-union laws, right, we need each other to be advocating for each other with each other.
To show their solidarity with their brothers and sisters in Michigan, Next Wave members stormed the emergency manager's office in Detroit, demanding that Governor Rick Snyder start focusing on policies that support working families.
We're going to start here at the Rensen. That's where there are some 800 people in town for a convention with the AFSCME Union, the American Federation of State, City, and Municipal Employees. Their target, right across the street, very easy, City Hall, but it's also where several thousand of their union brothers and sisters are facing real cuts.
We see the effects of the emergency manager every day. Overwhelmingly, in the 2012 elections, Michigan voters voted against having an emergency manager.
The governor's hand-picked emergency manager has free rein to privatize any services he chooses, slash pensions, disregard our contract, and trample our rights.
Coming to this conference just reminded me is that, you know, there's an assault on working families, of which, you know, this guy's the youngest guy here.
Too often, the game is rigged, and the rules are broken, and they're being broken by and on behalf of the richest and most powerful in this country. So here's our challenge. We need to change the rules.
It's very easy to feel demoralized, like all the power is in the hands of the system. But, you know, the people, in the end of the day, have the final verdict. And we can, if we come together, if we stand together, if we work together, we can use this breakdown to have a real breakthrough for justice.
The way that we're going to keep building is by getting young people involved. So I'm really happy that this conference is in Detroit, and I'm really happy that we're getting people involved in what's going on in Michigan and what's going on around the country.
I'm hoping for the future and revitalization of the labor movement.
Hello, brothers and sisters. I'm Al Garrett, president of AFSCME Council 25. As you know, Governor Rick Snyder has pushed the city of Detroit, our city, into bankruptcy. Instead of addressing the actual causes of the city's financial woes, the outsourcing of jobs, the erosion of the tax base, the hundreds of millions in state aid withdrawn over the past decade, he's instead targeting the women and men who call Detroit home and keep it running every day. The Detroit Free Press said bluntly in a recent editorial, "It's simply wrong as a moral imperative to snatch money out of old folks' pension checks, no matter how broke the city is. If you're getting only $1,600 a month, now subject to state income tax, even a small adjustment can be devastating. Many pensioners will have to turn to public assistance, lose their independence, or worse." AFSCME's fighting back. You earned your pension, you worked for your pension, and we in AFSCME are going to fight for you to keep your pension. Now, what are we going to do? We're going to fight in the courts. We brought in competent legal representatives to do that battle. But it also requires a battle from you. We're going to take it to the streets. We're going to take it where the public will know, the judge will know, the world will know that we're not about to give up benefits that we've earned. There is no denying that the Detroit financial condition is poor. Past decisions have been costly, but Governor Snyder has cut state shared revenue to Detroit by $60 million, and the city now gets only about half as much state revenue as it received 10 years ago. Because Snyder and the legislators in Lansing starved Detroit of state funds they should have shared, Detroit borrowed money from Wall Street to make ends meet. With the collapse of the housing market and population loss, it is now impossible for Detroit to repay those loans to the big bank. But I want to emphasize that this is no excuse for attacks on working people of Detroit. We are not and never were the cause of Detroit's economic problem. City workers have already made big concessions in pay and benefits. Non-uniform workers have already had their future pension benefits cut by almost 40%. And this year alone, they've already taken a 10% pay cut. We've asked the White House to convene an urban crisis task force immediately because the crisis in Detroit is playing out in cities across the country. Finally, we've also called on Snyder to restore the aid cut to Detroit during the past decade. I know that each one of you has made huge sacrifices to keep Detroit running. Bankruptcy is not the answer for Detroit. These are scary times. Rest assured that AFSCME is fighting for you. Remember, Detroit is far from the only city in hard times, and what happens here in Detroit matters to working people everywhere.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other, he was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking, they didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. Every single one of them are in cahoots. He's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia, too. He's a white man in a business suit. Sued by a lawyer, he was after my loot. He was a white man in a business suit. I got fired by my boss cause I wouldn't lick his boots. He was a white man in a business suit. I got evicted by my landlord cause my rent was overdue. He was a white man in a business suit. I got rejected for a loan at the financial institute by a white man in a business suit. I tried talking to my congressman, he didn't give a hoot. He was a white man in a business suit. Yeah!
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.